What's going on, guys? Welcome to the show. Welcome back to another Wednesday afternoon for John Wick Chapter 2, the sequel to 2014 surprise, magnanimous, incredible, fantastic, wonderful hit. We're so excited to break the whole thing down for you, and yeah, I'm back. We'll see you guys in just one second.
Welcome to Popcorn Talk, featuring movie discussion, news, and interviews. Popcorn Talk, we talk movies. And now, here's Popcorn Talk's Action Movie Anatomy.
Boom! What's up, everybody? Welcome to the show! Welcome back! Every time I hear the song now,
it's just so exciting.
You guys are amped! It's just like, man, sick! The song is just amazing. I love it.
Wow. Well, we realized after doing the Training Day episode that we were the most pumped when this song came on. So we're like, we'll just fucking use it every episode.
It's the theme song. Guys, welcome to the show. Welcome to Action Movie Anatomy, the only show on the Popcorn Talk Network or in the world breaking down only the greatest action movies of all time. Today, we're covering John Wick Chapter 2. I'm your host, Ben Bateman, joined today by two very special people. We're going to start with our special guest today.
More special.
He is a filmmaker. He is the CEO of Envelope Entertainment. His name is Brant Pinvidik. Welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, boys. Thanks for having me. Very excited.
He's in love with John Wick.
I am. Yeah. And listen, I love you guys. I watch your stuff all the time. So finding fellow action movie aficionados is very difficult.
Yeah.
Particularly in today's sort of ultra soft world.
Right.
So it's exciting to be here.
Yeah, thank you for coming, man. When I talked to you last week, you were like, John Wick is my favorite. I was like, well, it's a perfect time. I guess you got to just come on next week. Yeah, that's the only way we're going to do it.
So, and I saw it last night, so I'm all fresh.
Yeah.
John Wicked up.
Yeah. So we got my co-creator, co-producer, and co-host, Mr. Andrew Guy.
What's up, everybody? I'm John Wicked out in all black.
Looking good.
The dry cleaner did not mess up today.
Neither
like
of us
the Men in Black episode.
Did the button, though, right? He does like the little tie button.
I want that thing. I want that like bar that goes through.
Yeah.
You got one of those?
I do.
I got several.
See, yeah. I have the tie clips. I don't have the tie bars.
Yeah, the little thing through here.
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, we did it anyway. Welcome to the show, guys. This is Action Movie Anatomy. We're going to break down John Wick 2 for you today. Mm-hmm. This is an exciting one. John Wick 1, I realized, was the episode we did the week that this show hit 1 million total views.
Absolutely.
I remember this. Steph Z was on.
Yep.
We had a bottle of Johnny Walker, I think.
We did.
And
we got pretty drunk.
It was great. It was a really exciting day. That was like a year and change ago, and now we're at 10 million almost on the show.
Wow.
So
it's amazing what can happen in a year.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's a lot. It's been
congratulations,
really fun year.
Steph is just really good luck. Steph Z was on for our first episode that hit 1 million views.
Yep.
And she was on when our show hit 1 million views. And anyway, Steph, we love
Hats
you. We miss
Steph
you.
Z.
Wait till you see what I could do.
Yeah,
here,
right?
This is going to be
now
crazy.
You guys are really going to take off. So, guys, we break down action movies on the show. Those action movies adhere to four basic rules. Aside from being made after 1981, which is like a soft rule, that's not like really something we stick to. The rule number one is the hero always plays by their own rules. So, John Wick,
qualified.
Absolutely, no question. Rule number two, the hero and the villain are always the smartest people, beings, things, animals, dinosaurs, bears, whatever in the room. And John Wick definitely is. This guy's an idiot. He's not really the smartest guy in the room.
Yeah, he's an idiot, but thank God they gave him a little bit more vibrato and more evilness than, like, bad guys in the Mission Impossible new movies, the new James Bond
or the first
movies.
Yeah,
or
but
the first
to be fair,
Wick.
Though, he's the smartest guy in the room in the room's calculation of that. In what he needs to be doing, he's the smartest guy in that.
He
he's assessing everything.
Yeah, yeah.
He's making the call. That's why he continues to live and everybody else dies,
because
he's
the
smartest in that particular thing. I wouldn't put him in a Mensa exam or any of those things. He'd have trouble.
Yeah, he's no Hans Gruber,
he's
got... it's a good point.
And he would have survived.
Yeah.
John Wick actually had to break
his rules
in order to kill this guy. This guy was actually... he knew there was one place he could go. He loves duck fat.
Yeah.
So
he
could stay here for a long time and never eat the same thing.
Never eat the same meal.
Rule number three, the movie is driven by a police, military, or political figure. We add mercenary to this category, and John Wick is mercenary, so it's an easy one.
And the sort of bad guy syndicate...
Of the
continent. That sort of feels like sort of a political, military type thing. They sort of police.
It's like the Illuminati.
Police the group. So I qualify that as
Actually, excuse me. It's more like the Skulls.
Yeah. That's a good one. Rule number four, the movie contains a minimum of one explosion. Yeah, there's a handful in this movie.
I mean, his whole house gets blown up.
Big explosion.
Huge explosion. They don't kill the dog. That was good. I was glad they didn't kill the dog.
You can't kill the dog twice.
Yeah, that would have been
brutal. Yeah. I mean, it kind of would have been I think it would have been really dark comedy, but I'm glad they didn't.
No, it would have been
comedy?
Too much.
Like, I think it would have been one of those things where you're just
spoiler alert.
This is so bleak.
Yeah, exactly.
But in any case, that's the rules of the show. It pretty much fits. Fits better than some movies we do.
Absolutely.
And if you guys want to follow along in the conversation, we have some folks in the live chat. You can find us on Twitter. Each one of us is available. You can find me at Ben Bateman Media on Twitter and Instagram. Andrew, where can the folks find you?
You guys can find me in the same two places, at Andrew Guy.
And I'm at Brant Pinvidic on all those things, those social media thingamajigs.
Excellent. And you've got a film that came out a couple years ago and another one out now.
Yeah.
Yes. Both with similar titles, Why I'm Not on Facebook and Why I'm Not on Pokemon Go.
Yep.
So if people want to like see what you actually do creatively, they can watch those as well.
That's right.
Give us a quick breakdown of what that is, because I was looking at it, and I was looking at it last night, and it was super late, and I wanted to get more into it, but like I didn't have the time. So tell me a little bit more, and tell the audience about Why I'm Not on Pokemon Go.
So it was a continuation of my Why I'm Not on Facebook series, which was my first feature-length documentary. And so what I did was I took a subject, pop culture, very popular, Facebook. I wasn't on Facebook, hated Facebook, and I decided to do sort of like a 360 comedic view of why I'm not on this and what are really people like. And so it did very well, and did very well internationally, and so as I looked to expand that franchise, I looked for other sort of pop culture fads or things that are very popular, people are talking about that I would normally be super judgmental about. And Pokemon Go was the perfect thing at the time.
Right.
It was like, why are these idiots playing this game? My wife was playing it. Everybody I knew was playing it. I was like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever seen. But I learned from the Facebook thing, like sometimes if everybody's doing it and I'm the one not doing it, maybe I might be the problem in this sort of thing.
Well,
so
Pokemon Go left after like 6 weeks, so there's a reason the people, you were dead right on that one. Facebook is still a juggernaut, but...
So it was a... So I basically do sort of a comedic documentary look at those things. So now I'm expanding that into a few other areas. I have a podcast here with AfterBuzz as well, starting March 1st.
Cool.
And so I'll be doing Why I'm Not on various subjects every week.
Cool.
So it'll be kind of cool.
I am a huge Pokemon fan. You knew this about me. I die hard, had all the cards, loved the movies, played the games growing up, but I was the same way, man. I was like, I'm not going to fucking play Pokemon Go. I don't know why. I don't know if it's like, it might have been the same thing as when John Wick came out last year and everyone's like, it's so good, you have to see it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's like the stubborn, resilient
person. Right, of course. Yeah.
But I need to check this out because I still never got on it. I never hopped on the train.
The movie, it's a short. It's on YouTube. Yeah. It's free, which helps why it's done so well, I think. People don't have to pay for it.
Hey, we do free stuff,
too. It was great. But it really ended up not being about Pokemon Go itself. Like, it is an explanation of the game. It isn't about how to... It's none of that.
Right.
It's basically my 13-year-old daughter, I caught her sneaking out of the house to play the game, which sort of triggered to me, like, something is wrong. Like, she's not going sneaking out to go have sex with her boyfriend.
Right,
she's going out to walk around the neighborhood and hatch Pokemon eggs, which is just dumb. So it really turned into an exploration of the relationship that I had with my daughter, why she liked the game, how I wasn't communicating with her in the real world what she liked. And so I started to understand the appeal of the game as opposed to making a movie about the game. It was very, it turned very personal. And that's sort of my approach to these subjects is I'm a very judgmental person. So is everybody.
Everyone is.
You know.
Yeah, right.
And I've just decided, like, maybe I'll look into things just one step deeper before I cast judgment.
Yeah.
And so far, when I do that, it's like, I'm the jackass. So I'm two for two for being the jackass.
She was sneaking out to play Pokemon. You're like, you get three strikes, sweetheart. Use your strikes better.
Yeah. Your strikes way better than this.
Yeah, it was crazy. So
it's amazing.
All right, guys. Well, you can check that out, and we will talk to you a little bit more about what you have coming at the end of the show. But for right now, we're going to get into the trailer for John Wick 2. We're going to examine what we saw here, what we saw in the theaters, and then get into thesis statement.
There will be spoilers in this episode.
Yeah, this is that weird thing they're doing now where they front porch trailers with like 1.5 seconds. I don't really know. It's weird.
I need you to do this task.
I'm not that guy.
I need you to stay on it.
I'm not that guy.
Not always that guy, John.
I can't help you.
You know the rules. If you don't do this,
his delivery was
the consequences.
Really robotic.
Yeah.
Now that you know the character fit,
it's perfect.
Oh yeah, I love this.
Yeah.
The world is so cool. It was the coolest part of the whole movie by far.
The contract has gone international.
You have no idea what's coming.
I like that they all had the same phone, right? Like all that weird.
Oh yeah.
Please get this man a gun.
Lawrence Fisher was sending out phone.
Yeah. Like SIM cards on the carrier pigeons, yeah.
To him, this isn't vengeance. This is justice.
That's one thing you see in all these spy movies is, unless it's like a gadget to do something, they all use old phones, like old tosser burner phones.
Whoever comes, I'll kill them all. I'll kill them all.
Of course you will.
Watching the trailer makes me feel like this movie was like the coolest thing I've ever seen.
Yeah.
Actually,
I
really liked it. I didn't like love it. I really liked it. But then the trailer makes me feel like I loved it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. The trailer gets you out.
Yeah, the trailer's pretty good.
That was a good trailer. It's got a lot of sweet action. But also, like, some of the, like, you saw the clips of scenes, and then I remember the whole scene. The whole scene is, like, insane, so maybe it balances out. I don't know. So we're going to get into thesis statement, guys. This is that thing we do every show where we share our boldest, biggest, most profound statement about the film. If somebody walks up to you at a party, and they're like, hey, I just saw Armageddon. You're like, let me tell you about Armageddon. You have your thing you can convince them of, so it should be almost rooted in hyperbole, very fact-driven.
Not like, this is my favorite John Wick or my favorite Keanu. This is the greatest Keanu Reeves film ever.
The
things
first,
like that.
The only. If it's an opinion, it should be, this is the reason this is the way it is.
Yep.
So we're each going to share ours. Would one of you like to jump in with yours first?
I want to either go first or last.
I'll go first.
Okay.
I'll go first.
All right.
John Wick's success as a cult classic and the success of John Wick 2 is proof, once again, that Hollywood has no idea what it's doing right now when it comes to non-franchised action films. None at all. Taken was the first example we got 8-9 years ago. John Wick's the same thing.
Why do you say no idea? Because I feel like they're definitely pigeonholing the idea. Like with, I feel like with the Wicks, the Reachers, and the Equalizers of the world, they're getting like steps closer to what they want.
Well, here's what I think. So if you look at the movies that Keanu Reeves did before John Wick 1, his career was flattering. He was in a place where he wasn't doing high-profile movies. I mean, 2008, I think he did like The Day the Earth Stood Still or something like that.
Yes, very bad.
The next 6 years was like some combination of Lake House-esque movies, movies that nobody was watching, essentially. Mm-hmm. If they knew this movie was going to be a success, they wouldn't have cast Keanu Reeves, is the bottom line. There was other people in 2014 that were much more bankable than Keanu Reeves. It's the same thing in 2008. If they knew Taken was going to have two sequels and make much more money with the second and third movie, they wouldn't have cast Liam Neeson.
Listen, if you could sort of predict like that, you could be a great studio executive.
100%. So what I'm
saying, when you come and pitch the movie of a first-time director and a writer who's a stuntman and say, hey, we have an action movie where he just kills people over his dog and it stars Keanu Reeves, I don't know that it's fair to look at the studios and be like, wow, they should have green like that. That was an obvious
one. Because in an interview that I was watching today with Basil Iwaniak, he was talking about how he was trying to romanticize the first movie.
Yeah.
And it was actually an interview done by Collider. And he's like, you know, it's more than a story about a guy that lost his dog. You know, we didn't want it to just be that. And the guy's like, that's what it is.
Yeah.
That's why we love it. It's about a guy going on a vengeance trip because they killed his dog. And Basil was like, I mean, Basil or whatever, how you said, he was like, yeah, I mean, you're right. So I do agree with you to an extent.
Well, here's what I mean, though. If you look back in the old days, it wasn't that all of the tentpole movies in the summer were driven by franchises and superheroes and Harry Potter 6 and 7. You didn't have 7, 8 Fast and Furious movies. Back then, when you made the 7th and 8th thing, it was Police Academy. Nobody saw those movies.
Yes.
You could do Cliffhanger. You could do Commando. You could do Predator. And people would see the movies. They would go to the theater to see an original franchise with a star, and that's how it worked. And nowadays, they try that. That often fails. So what I'm saying is, I think we're in an era because of Redbox generation where everything is VOD, and you can basically make a movie for $20, $30, $40 million, hope to make your money back. There is no precedent anymore for making movies like this. John Wick is an accident. So is Taken.
Yes.
Like,
yeah, absolutely.
But also, what you're failing to understand is the proliferation of content itself has contributed to this, because at the end of the day, you can't get noticed in today's world of content. You can't put out a movie without stars and a hook and expect people to get there. And $40 million, you need people to get there. So to pitch the idea of John Wick was kind of absurd. So when Lionsgate sort of took this risk, I would say that's like a very bold move on their statement, on their behalf, because you could not have expected people to find this movie. And if it wasn't what it was, if it was one misstep off, one headshot away from being a piece of shit, and you know what? Everything worked. It was It's like the New England Patriots in the Super Bowl comeback in the fourth quarter of movies, where every single thing had to work exactly perfect to make that movie work. And it's not possible for anybody to sort of predict these things.
I agree. So you're dead right about that. What I'm trying to say is, I think it was easier back in the day. There was more of a formula that worked. And nowadays, it's just this is proof to me, like, that they're willing to bankroll this movie now, and Keanu Reeves is a massive star again because of John Wick, is like, nobody has any idea what they're doing. And I'm not saying it's their fault.
By the way, and you're 100% right. Same thing we do in TV. It's completely random. And 90% of the things we do fail. So we don't know shit about shit.
Equivalent of striking gold or oil in the movie business.
Yeah. But in the 1990s, there's no YouTube.
Yeah.
There's no Netflix. There's
a star to drive a movie.
Content.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's like when you put out a movie on the weekend, that's the movie on the weekend.
Yeah.
And that's it. There's nowhere else to get it. And you could go down to Blockbuster and rent last, like, a year ago movie. Because remember, they held those things from the theater for like 6 months, 9 months. So, yeah, you could launch all those movies and they all sort of get sampled. So, but now there is no version of that.
Yeah.
Like, you don't have to go to the movies on the weekend.
It makes the success of a John Wick that much more impressive. That is my thesis. Who wants to go next?
What do you got, Brent?
Okay. John Wick 2.
Yep.
John Wick 2 is the most advanced, skilled, choreographed extras and stuntman in movie-making history.
Wow. John Wick 2.
John Wick 2.
I'm going to have to strongly disagree with Mad Max Fury Road.
No. Ooh. Here's the thing. Okay.
Here's why I state this way.
Okay.
When you look at the way John Wick 2 was shot,
right,
and the number of incoming behind-the-shoulder shots of Keanu Reeves, headshotting and chest-shotting and shooting over and over again, I want you to, for a minute,
right,
picture being an extra or a stuntman trying to choreograph that moment. When he pulls the trigger and your script goes off and you have to sell the audience that you just got your head blown off and now you have to be completely still. By the way, the key to the movies, both of them, were the number of headshots and the way they were final executed.
Right? Yeah.
When you watch this movie, there are 15 of them going on at once, over and over again, in single camera shots.
Yeah.
And I was watching, because there's a lot of them, so you can think a lot of things. You have time. I was like, how on earth did they time all of this and sell it? If you're in Mad Max, getting blown up, getting thrown off a thing is good, amazing stunt work.
Right.
But the choreograph moves that they had to pull off in John Wick 2 was absolutely astronomical.
I will jump on Andrew's point, though, and say, when we did the Mad Max episode, we pulled the 25-minute behind-the-scenes B-roll stuff, and it's no cuts, single cam, watching what's happening from like 100 feet away. And you have Cirque du Soleil actors that are on swinging poles between two moving convoys, changing sticks and jumping from car to car,
holding your leading actor's
with
face,
real
next
explosions
to the
going off. Yeah. I mean, I agree with you.
Pulling
it's
away from what you're
unbelievable.
Saying.
Unbelievable. Yeah. I would say it's at least on par, but I think to unequivocally say it, and it's your thesis. So
that's my thesis, and I'm sticking with it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I like
you
it.
I just know the timing of that is. Listen, they could have shot the one in Mad Max 15 different times and used probably all 15 takes because you have no idea what it's supposed to look like or how it's supposed to work. In John Wick, when he pulls a trigger at your head, you have to do it exactly and precisely. And they did it every time. And there was six of them in the same area doing the same thing. It's like, to time that is ridiculously difficult.
The precision is what makes the movie.
The precision
what it is.
It was unbelievable. When you think about
editing,
those
filming, the blood splatter, the precision in every movement in this film.
What I was going to say is, I was listening to a Keanu Reeves interview this week, and he is legendary in the action circle for the number of moves he can do in one take without a cut, the number of choreographed moves, like Cruise-esque in Last Samurai kind of a thing. But like, it's like 16, 18, 19 moves without a cut of choreographed. So that's probably how they're able to do it, is like,
and
can
by the way,
try to
he
get,
can rehearse the same thing over and over again and make it happen. But to have 15 extras
and stunt guys,
in that kind of timing, for I think the gunshots, and particularly gunshots of the head, where it's not like, oh, my chest,
it's like, just like a quick neck snap and a fall.
That's right,
because
and it
it's
was
not the church
flawless.
Scene. It's not the church scene from
Kingsman
where it's
you
just
shoot
sped
it slow
up,
and you rewind
which
it.
Is unbelievable. But it's like much easier to shoot that because you can do everything in slow motion,
slow, and then you just speed it up. Yeah, I agree.
So, what do you got, Andrew?
So my thesis is that the only reason, we always talk about this on the show, that the best parts of every action movie are not the action scenes, although with John Wick, it's pretty damn hard to argue that.
Yeah.
It's actually the scenes in between. And I still think that holds true in this film. Not necessarily that there's, like, great gravitas and acting and tour de forces. No. I'm talking about this intricate world that they created for the Continental and the Hitman Society. This international world, this that is in and out and every single aspect of life, from the most, like, all the way up to the Pope, down to every single homeless person in New York, for instance. So I think that the only reason this movie is as successful as it is because they created a world that was so fascinating and believable that as an audience member, you're like, fuck yeah, I'm on board. Like, if John Wick's gonna go around and kill people all over the world, he has to have a real way to do this.
Yeah.
How do they have They have blueprints of the catacombs in Rome. They have everything, and I thought that was the coolest thing about this movie.
The attention to detail with that stuff was, like, so cool. He goes to see the gun sommelier.
Yeah.
And all of, and just, you know, all of the, like metaphors for, you know, the big, bold finish.
The lingo, exactly.
I loved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was so cool. I mean, just every part of it. I loved the tailor, and he's got the... I mean, it was way over the top, obviously, but the end of it.
But it's
like,
perfect. Yeah. You know, in these type of movies, that was the coolest thing. I mean, what was the coolest thing about every single Pierce Brosnan and James Bond?
Yeah, right.
It was when he goes to talk to Q.
Yeah,
he gets his cool gadgets, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar with Kingsman. Like that's one of the things that made Kingsman.
I feel like they gave a nod to the people that loved the movie to say, like, okay, we're going to give you a little more fun in this one. We're going to have play with it. We're not going to try to connect the dots in such an intricate way that you have to not have your suspense of disbelief. Once you're in, let's have a little fun. Well, and I liked that it was like, it felt like a nod to an audience that knew what was going on.
Well, and you were there with me.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
you heard, I was laughing like the whole movie, but it wasn't like, this is ridiculous. It was like, this is awesome.
Yeah, right.
This is exactly what I want.
Well, because I think one thing I noticed was the first movie is like, he should have been dead for sure.
Yeah.
But it was like, okay, but he's like just pushing himself. This movie, he was a superhero. This movie, he should have been dead 17 times.
Yeah, and that was my main criticism of this particular movie.
Is really
the superhero aspect of it was too much for me.
Just him getting hit by cars.
His magical suit was just like, come on.
There's too much of this, like, just kind of holding, like, laser.
Yeah, he was like, like Batman's cape. Yeah. Like, no. And I don't think it needed that. I don't want to get too critical of the movie, because
I agree, though.
But I think if they had dialed some of the number of bad guys, the number of firing shots that they had to do, the people he killed, it would have kept it a little more, I hate to say believable, because it's so absurd, but it doesn't matter. Like, it was, he had a superhero quality that detracted from the character for me.
I get you on that.
And I needed him to be a little more realistic in his awesome snipering super bad guy, I'm a crazy assassin, and it was more like, I'm Spider-Man kind of thing, which I thought was like, it was just a little too much.
Yeah. One thing that I did, I mean, and to hop on that, I totally agree. One thing that we talk about in improv, and I always reference improv on the show, is you don't have to talk about, if you're going like this, you don't need to say you're holding a gun.
Yeah.
The audience can figure it out that you're probably holding a gun.
Yep.
So, for instance, if you have this big, long breakdown and, like, his tailored suit and the crotch is tactical and it's bulletproof, you don't need to show us every single time he's battling that his coat is bulletproof.
Right.
They remind us consistently and constantly. It's so redundant. You're like, we get it.
Yeah.
Stop holding it. Because, honestly, if you're going to hold up your suit like this and it's bulletproof, if it gets shot, the thing's just going to flip up.
Well, and,
you know?
And like, the truth is, like, you can't get hit with that suit. Like, you won't die, but you're out.
Yeah.
You're done.
And when him and Common exchanged those few
shots, like,
it's
cool.
And by
the way, I would have been okay with that if that was the one or
that
maybe
cool.
one other one.
Yeah.
And if you would have had a little bit more reaction to the sort of bullet that actually, like, rocked you, I would have been okay with that, because then it would have been like, okay, he's going to kill a lot of people and there's going to be a lot of shots exchanged, and so he's going to get shot a couple times.
Yeah.
And I would have been okay with that. But this was, he couldn't get shot.
Yeah.
You couldn't shoot the guy back, and you're like, okay, like, at some point, the coolness of his moves is like, you don't need all those, obviously. John, you could just go up and just walk through
it. Out. Yeah. And audience, we're not saying that the suit isn't awesome, trust me. We think the suit is awesome.
Super sweet.
You can just always reel things in just a little bit.
A little bit. But the nature of this movie was to not reel things in.
It was too. I want to jump in with this real quick, because we had AMA questions. We only had a few this week, and I kind of touched on it a little bit just now, but I want to talk about it just a little bit more. This is from Josh Ryan Sports. He always asks great questions. He says, is this the greatest pure action sequel of all time? Pure action sequel of all time.
So we immediately count out Terminator 2, because that movie is rooted in more of a dramatic.
So I have a little list here. And it's
T2 is the
first
greatest
one
action movie of all time. Terminator 2.
T2 is the first one that pops
into
my mind.
So.
X2 is next.
X2 is
Spider-Man 2.
Action. Yeah,
and Aliens.
Yeah, Aliens is the best example of straight action, because everything's so different from the first movie.
Hmm.
I don't know if you have any, or like if you have any that pop into mind. Like, some that I do, they aren't strictly action. They're mostly action dramas or like fantasy action, like, you know, Lord of the Rings, Two Towers
has a lot of great action.
But, and a lot of the other ones on the list fell in that category. So, is this the greatest pure action sequel of all time? How do you guys have anything to weigh in on that?
I think this is a unique movie. Okay, direct sequel?
Because
Mad Max Fury Road is a sequel.
No, direct sequel.
So not
the second film.
If it's the second film, then I think probably the answer is yes. I mean, only because we've almost never really seen action executed in a movie to the degree that either the first or second movie did.
I think if you narrow down the field enough and close the doors to a lot of these things and say pure action, there aren't a lot of good movies to begin with. So the fact that this one is good and holds your attention and is really super cool, even the criticisms make it probably the best of the mediocre, just pure action movies.
I mean, the visceral nature of the action sequences in this movie are... Oh, so what did somebody just say? The Raid 2? So
yeah, The Raid 2, it's interesting, but the thing that's tough is The Raid 1 is so much better in my mind.
Oh, The Raid Redemption is the first
one. The Raid Redemption is the first one.
They just renamed it.
And I feel like The Raid Redemption is so much better than The Raid 2, whereas... If John Wick and John Wick 2, like, John Wick is better than John Wick 2, in my opinion, but it's not, like, leaps and bounds greater, you know? I think it's better, but I think The Raid 2 and The Raid Redemption
leaps
are
and half a bound.
Yeah, maybe half a bound. There we go.
And a full leap. Yeah, two leaps and half a
and
bound.
A half a bound.
To acknowledge you, Josh, I mean, the action in this movie is groundbreaking. Like, it really is. So still is. And I would say, so the answer to that question is probably yes. But if somebody was to tweet at us and let us know that they had a different opinion, I don't know that I could say invariably you're wrong. So,
All right, moving on.
Let's get into the most awesome things about the movie. This is fist pump moment, guys. This is that moment in the movie. Something happens. You look around. You're like, are you seeing this right now? You're watching the movie at home. Maybe you call your buddy. You're like, go to 1732 right now. I know you've seen the movie. Just go right now. You have to watch this.
I'm having dinner with my grandmother, Ben.
Yeah. I don't care. This is so good. You have to watch this. And it's just the fucking greatest thing. Can be anything. Can be a headshot. Can be the music. Can be the title credits. A co-star. Anything. This movie is one of those movies that
the whole thing is a fist pump.
It's constructed to be one giant exploding fist pump the whole time.
Yeah.
But for my money, the fist pump moment in this movie, I thought it was the car swing, but I'll leave that.
Yeah, because you and I both looked at, we kind of fist pumped in the beginning when he does the car swing into the pole, which is great.
It's when the $7 million contract goes out. And Wick gets confronted in that fucking subway. He ends up doing the pencil move.
Yeah.
And it's the whole combination of that assassinate, like, they're trying to kill him. He takes down three people. And then
the fucking pencil.
And then the pencil, dude, just like through the ear. It was like, it was everything that Joker
through
did.
Through the ear, and he kept hitting it. And
everything that Joker did, but even more graphic. And then he pulls the guy off, and he's still got the pencil.
Yeah.
It was one of those, like, oh, yes.
Yeah.
That was pretty good.
It was brilliant. That was so just violent.
That was amazing. And the big Subo guy starts to get up, and he's already shot him through the top of the head. He has to pop again. Yeah, that was nuts.
It was hilarious.
You guys are
to me.
Savage.
Yeah.
Love it.
Amazing. All right. Mine, it was going to be the car flip as well, because it happened so early on, you're like, fuck yes.
It's really cool move.
It's so good, and it's hilarious. Yeah. The guy's like,
and you can see it coming for a little bit, and you're like, oh, yeah.
And it's like so much more brutal than you think it's going to be. But I think mine is the whole sequence with the with the shotgun, the tactical shotgun that's fully automatic. Like, maybe the very last part where he puts the last clip in and shoots the dude in the head.
Yeah.
But every shot with that shotgun is so devastating.
Yeah.
Like, I was sitting there just like, oh, like, it was like, I was like a kid watching my favorite thing in the world happen. Like, the headshots, the leg shots. Yeah. It was just, people were getting destroyed.
Yeah. They set it up so well, too. And this is the thing about it that's so great. It's like, as an action movie, it's brilliant for him to go in, just like a video game, leave his guns in place.
Yep.
So you're like, he's going to come back through here. And you're like, when's he going to get to the shotgun?
Yeah, right.
He's going to finish it off with a shotgun. And each one's even better, you know? It's like, he's devastating with a pistol. Then he's got the fucking awesome rifle.
Yeah,
and then the shotgun. Yeah, I agree. That was unbelievable.
It was amazing.
Yeah. Mine's a little more nuanced.
Okay.
A little bit more...
Can be anything.
A little bit more of a focused moment than these wild things. So, and for me, when I look at literally, like, when was that moment that I was like, oh, shit, it's on now?
Yeah.
Was after the assassination, after Common, and he started the first run, there was a moment... He killed a guy on the dance floor, which was amazing. He got just off the dance floor in the back, and it was a over-the-shoulder shot, and it was a long view shot, and a guy came around the corner, and it was this perfectly executed body head shot. Bang, bang! And the extra was in clear view over his shoulder, and the perfect shot of, like, bang, bang in the head, and he dropped like an absolute sack of potatoes.
Yes.
And I was like, holy shit!
Yeah.
Because you hadn't seen much of that. If it's a sniper movie, it's you just see a close up of the person, right?
Yeah.
If it's most of the gunplay, it's at close range or you cut to see the shot. This was a long range shot where the extra came in and it was a full screen view.
Right. You're talking
and
about
it was like bang bang.
He's next to the big white orb.
Yes,
and it splatters on the orb right here.
Yes,
right.
Yeah. And you're just like
yeah.
And the extra comes running into the scene and he just goes bang bang. it's body head, and the guy just goes bang bang. And
it's video game filmmaking,
and
it's,
I was like, oh yes,
it's like better than video game filmmaking because you're never that accurate.
It was sick.
We just covered Collateral on the show a few weeks ago, and that is one of those movies where it's like bang bang headshot. Tom Cruise, because he's a fucking surgeon.
Double tap entry wound to the sternum and one in the head.
Yes, and by the way, that's what this was, but. I would say film better than almost anyone I've ever seen. I've never seen one film that good and give that a real life effect, because it's at the depth, and it's like there was no cutting. You didn't have to cut to the bad guy getting shot.
Right. The devastation of the bullets landing is one of the most satisfying things to watch
but
in this movie.
Didn't you find that, like, I found it got too video gamey in the catacombs. Like, it was many people and so many shots that it's like, I wanted to appreciate the maestro at play here. And I even found with the jiu-jitsu, which I'm a crazy jiu-jitsu fan, and all of the sort of action, I found like it was so much, so many, that it kind of like, I wanted to like breathe it in a little bit and enjoy it. Like, and they had, in John Wick, the original, it was a little bit more of the individual one-on-one bad guys that had some real stakes and he had to overcome them. And the way he did that, I got to enjoy more. I found there was a lot of the gunplay here that I didn't get to enjoy as much because it was turned into like a video game just blasting.
And it's because they want quality over quantity.
Yeah.
I mean, quantity over quality when they should have switched it because
they had both.
Exactly.
They had both.
And there's the thing, literally all of our complaints are coming from overdoing things, like getting shot too many times, killing too many people, having too many of the same jiu-jitsu moves, which by the end of it, it's like, you know he's going to do the flip. You know he's going to, like, he did it maybe 10 times in the movie. I think that this is...
Or 30.
Exactly. Like, quality suffered from quantity.
Time. I mean, it was a little too... It was like a little bit of the Man of Steel effect. You know, in Man of Steel, once the fight starts over the city, after 2 minutes of it, you're like... I'm over this.
You're going to go through more buildings.
I don't need to see you blow up more buildings. Like, this is just not exciting anymore. And not to say that it wasn't cool, but...
It was super cool.
The coolest thing in both John Wick movies to me is the very first assassination in his house. That entire sequence where he takes out the, like, whatever it is, like 11 guys.
The very first time you see him
He kills
fight.
All the guys. He does the flip once or twice. He's perfect on his shots. And it's the first time you've seen him do it.
And you're like, what was that?
And it feels like he's using his gun as, like, his fist almost. And he's shooting over people's shoulders. That was the coolest thing. Because I looked up, you know, you were interacting with one of our fans on Twitter yesterday. I saw about a whole conversation.
Gun fu and all that.
Yeah, the whole conversation about headshots and the artistry of headshots. So I looked up Equilibrium because I haven't seen it in a long time. The old Cronenberg movie with Christian Bale.
And
it's like a precursor to The Matrix a little bit. It's like just a softer version. And they do this thing in that movie called a gun kata, which is like this incredible, like, you know, samurai gun training thing.
Like, you move your guns.
And it's cool. It's definitely cool. It's not as cool as Bullet Time. It's not as cool as any of the moves they pull in The Matrix. It's definitely not as cool as John Wick. But watching that, the clips, I was like, I mean, this is just the difference of time. This is just the difference of stuntmen who have done this for since that movie came out, making their own movie now.
And it's, I mean, directorially, the choices they made were bold.
Yeah.
And it, again, it just shows, like, we're so savage.
Yeah.
Our culture.
We really are.
And that was, like, I debated whether that would be my thesis statement about John Wick. And John Wick 2 basically says we've arrived at the height of our savageness as moviegoers, which is really a human condition, is like, we want to watch people execute. We're just so raw. And this is sort of like now being able to watch it in this definitive blast your brains out. It's like, instead of being horrified, we're like, yes, his brains went flying, you know?
Yeah.
And that's just like, that's gladiator shit right there. Like,
I was almost going to say it's like crazy because our audience, they want that without feeling. You know what I mean? Like, they don't want to feel invested in the character. They don't want to have, like, the heartbreak of it. They just like that. But then, honestly, in this movie, when the sister dies, not only is that the most incredible bathroom I've ever seen in my entire
amazing
life.
Amazing bathroom. But by the way, almost a fist bump moment for me as well.
When she
because
dies
was like, I didn't want her to die, but part of me was like, what the fuck? Don't let, like, he's supposed to be the assassin. Like, oh man, like, is this going to turn into one of these things? And I was trying to make the plot in my brain going like,
it's a cool scene.
Okay, he's going to spare her and then he's going to go kill the brother. Like,
exactly.
Oh, damn it. And I was kind of disappointed. And then all of a sudden it's like, wait a second. Like,
she knows.
This bitch is getting killed.
She knows he's never going to walk away.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was like, yes. That was right at the edge of my fist bump moment of like, oh my God, like, they are not going to let this movie off the hook. This is what this is.
Exactly.
And that was amazing.
And if they did, if they let her live, or if they would have done any of that, and if it didn't happen the way it did, this movie would have just completely fallen on, like, just fallen on
Yes. Yeah, I agree with you completely. So yeah, I think that pretty well explores our fist pump
moment. Let's move into
let's move on to star profiles. It's kind of an interesting one. So we have two stars. You have Keanu and you have Ricardo Scamarcio. He's an Italian actor who is a big Italian actor interested in producing over there, and he's not really known over here.
No, I mean,
he fits the role well. He looks like the guy that he should look.
Yeah, and he's been in a few American movies. He was in My Brother is an Only Child, which I think is actually Italian, but it was more well-received over here.
And Burnt, which I think I saw. Wasn't it the Bradley Cooper one?
Yeah, it's the Bradley Cooper one about food trucks and all that.
Yeah, it was on an airplane.
So that is the biggest American movie he's been a part of.
Yeah, I don't remember him in the movie, to be honest.
And that was just 2 years ago, so he's still trying to break through.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, insert bad guy there.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, we complained a little bit in John Wick 1 that the bad guy there... He's as lifeless as he is in Mission Impossible 4. He looks great, but he's just nothing. He has a few lines. It's like not even believable that he could kick John Wick's ass at the end on a bridge.
Yeah, for a minute.
That doesn't even begin to convince you. And this guy was better because he's more of a shit weasel, which is good.
Yeah, but in the first one he said he's the man you sent to kill the fucking boogeyman. So you don't need to do anything else after that. Like that was kind of his whole role, and it was like okay.
Yeah, I'll give it to you.
I loved him.
So then moving over to Keanu, just like I was saying in the thesis,
travesty.
But this is really weird. So so Taken, when Liam does Taken, the next stretch of his career is, you know, A Walk Amongst the Tombstones and Run All Night and Taken 2 and Taken 3. And
those were all basically Taken.
He did every action movie he could get his hands on. He did a couple movies like Third Person with Paul Haggis and a few dramas, but he really embraced the action thing. He was like, I'm going to be the action guy. Maybe because he hadn't been in his career prior to Taken, so he was like, this is a fun thing I get to do in my 50s.
I could see that.
Keanu, I mean, John Wick was a big thing, and people loved that movie.
People forgot he was an action star until John Wick came out.
But if you look at what he was in the next few years, and even what he's been in now, I mean, movies like Knock Knock, movies like Generation movies like The Neon Demon, which is the Nicholas Winding Refn movie with, what's her name, Elle Fanning from, just last year. That's the highest profile one. The Bad Batch, The Whole Truth.
It's a bad thing if you want to talk about the movie he's been in, and you got to go to IMDb to figure it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Totally. So it's none of this is coming from memory.
It's so weird because he loves movies like this. He loves doing these weird indie small films that are just weird roles. Like Knock Knock was one of the first movies I'd seen in a while that I was like, oh, Keanu's doing like a Hollywood horror blockbuster.
Yeah.
And I was actually kind of excited to see it.
Blockbuster used loosely.
It really was supposed to be that, because it was riding the coattails of John Wick, that Keanu is back. That movie
flopped.
But you know what? Yeah. Here's the thing. Movie making takes a long time.
Yeah.
Greenlighting stuff is really hard. John Wick did not take off, and it grew, and it takes a long time for a studio or studio execs or anybody or overseas for everybody to go like, oh my God, that is a success, right? Like, we all loved it, so we think it's the greatest thing in the world, but dollars and cents and numbers and viewers and things, like, it take a long time for that movie to be classified as a hit and as a bankable hit.
And then only the execs know about that.
Because,
most of the general audience, middle America especially, they don't know that it's a hit until after the second one's out.
And by the way, and that's really the only way you explain to people to go see John Wick. I just had my brother the other day, who's a crazy action fan.
Yeah.
You've seen John Wick, right? He's like, no. And so I could explain it to him, and like I could explain it's the greatest thing ever, but I have to say it's a huge cult hit. People never even really saw it in the movie, and now everybody's talking about it, and that that's taken a while to get there.
Everybody, we talked about just the other day, because the discussion about Moonlight and why that movie has been so successful and will it have a chance to beat La La Land, which it won't, but the whole conversation of like, if a movie makes a lot of money, if a movie makes a ton of money and gets a lot of awards, people know that it's good. Prior to the award season, if it doesn't make a ton of money, people need to be told what's good and what's not.
Exactly.
That's none of us are advanced enough if there's not a star attached with a movie like Moonlight, and there's kind of a star, but like not like a movie star, to know what to watch.
Agreed.
So John Wick comes out, Keanu Reeves hasn't done a relevant movie. I mean, this 47 Ronin, I'm assuming, cost three times as much as John Wick to make.
No one
saw it.
Yeah. And I mean, cost a lot of my life watching it.
Yeah,
exactly. I'd like to send them a bill for that to get some of my time back.
So it's not just like, put him in an action movie, it'll be good. It's like you said, nobody knew John Wick was going to be good. Mm-hmm. This movie was a total accident. So John Wick 2 now, because people, this is going to make a lot of money, I'm thinking. I know it did pretty well the first weekend, made all of its money back. The next phase is the one that we should be watching for. What does he do over the next 3 or 4 years? But I will tell you this. In the interview that I listened to him on this week, he talks about movies, and he's like, look, I just want to make things that I want to make. I don't really... She's like, John Wick was really cool. I really liked doing that. I love being an action guy. And, you know, thank you to Catherine Bigelow for putting me in Point Break as my first action movie because it changed my life. But he's like, please go see the documentary I made about, you know, the digitization moving... or film moving to digital. Go see this movie, Generation If you never watched Scanner Darkly, please watch that. Like, he's like, I've done enough. I'm not making movies to make money. I'm making movies to make movies at this point. I believe him. If you look at the choices,
I think the biggest problem with Keanu, though, and it's gonna, it hurts to say this.
Yeah,
he's not that good of an actor. That's why. That is why you see him making these movies and like, and that's why we're not.
Nah, I don't agree.
I do. I mean, I agree with myself. I think this is a reason of why his career is not skyrocketing. He's in that rough age of being like, are you too old to be an action star? Are you too young to be a dad?
Right.
And he's not a good enough actor to be thrown and thrust into those roles and succeed.
I think your thesis from John Wick 1 was that Keanu Reeves is like the worst actor to work with the greatest directors of all time or something like that.
It was probably something about how he's the worst actor put in the greatest positions.
I mean, he's been made fun of on like a Schwarzenegger level for years about being a bad actor.
He's not a good actor.
It's a joke. He's a perplexing actor. I can't say that he's a great actor because he's never convinced me with his dramatic roles. But at the same time, I love Keanu Reeves movies. I love Keanu Reeves in those movies.
I love Keanu Reeves movies, and I love Keanu Reeves in those movies.
Yeah.
But what we're talking about is Keanu Reeves in the movies you love are mostly all action movies.
Yeah,
it's true. Or him in an earlier part of his career. You look at his career now and the movies that he does and the movies that he wants to do, he's not good enough to carry.
So Brent, are you think he is a good actor, I'm assuming.
I think he's pretty good because I think the character he brings to the specific movie makes the movie. And I think if you're an actor, and listen, I'm a little bit jaded because I'm in the business.
Yeah.
So I don't have the same sort of artsy look at things that a lot of sort of the fans like. I'm like dollars and cents and success. And the guy gets a role and usually he kind of nails it and it makes that movie work. And then you can say like, well, it was a simple role or he didn't have a lot of lines or whatever. But like, that's an actor's job is to like nail the role. So is it Citizen Kane? Could he pull that kind of stuff up? I don't think so, but nobody would cast him.
So by that argument, then you would say Arnold Schwarzenegger is a good actor.
I think Arnold Schwarzenegger has been a great actor for what he's done because he sold it so well.
That's the same thing as Keanu, though.
Yeah. So then to that end, if that's your opinion that if it is successful and he is in successful franchises and convinces you in those franchises,
right?
I can understand that argument. I think you're coming from, and I agree with you, it's a different point of view.
But if you're a character, like if you have a natural personality, it's like playing into that personality. Is that really that difficult? Like if you're Anthony Hopkins and you play those roles, is that all that difficult for him? That's his personality.
Yeah, but where it's like if you took Jack Sir Black, Anthony Hopkins to Keanu Reeves, who's like an incredible
I'm just saying that they're very different skill sets.
Absolutely.
And so it's like calling one an actor who's a good actor, bad actor. I get it. There's obviously differences in the level of sophistication of the acting. But if you put Jack Black and you try to get him to be Conan the Barbarian, he'd have a hard time pulling that role off. You know what I mean? Like, because that's a personality that you need to be to make those things work.
Probably be just like hilarious.
It'd be hilarious, but that's the point.
So Jack Black was given, what was that movie he was just in, the biopic about that weird guy that committed murder? He's like super. Can you look that up real quick, Marissa? Jack Black. You guys will know exactly what it is. It came out really recently. He plays like a gay, like weird, squirrely. Keanu Reeves cannot do that.
Sure.
He cannot transform to carry a drama biopic unless it's about a guy that is like Keanu Reeves.
I am in full agreement with you, by the way. I'm trying to dignify both points here.
I agree with what he's saying. I think Keanu Reeves has been incredibly successful in the positions he's been put in, and I love him.
Because I think when you look at the things he's been put in, like when he gets put in Shakespeare in the 90s, he's not good. Like, those are the roles where they try to put him into...
Bernie,
oh, yeah, Bernie. Yeah, I remember that.
Thank you, Marissa.
When you put him in those types of roles and you try to stretch him, which good actors, when they're put in both roles, can do, like Liam Neeson, for instance, can be in Taken and blow your mind. He can also win an Oscar. Like, that's the kind of thing that I would say that's a good actor to me. I understand... Yeah. Yeah, it's two different opinions.
So instead of talking about this forever, let's get into our next point, which this is segueing perfectly into, which is career-defining roles for Keanu Reeves.
Yeah, so the question we ask sometimes, we can't do it on every episode because not everybody has this, but he's right in that interesting thing where does Keanu Reeves have a career-defining role? A clear, no question, it's at the top billing, and you would say, when you say Keanu Reeves, I think this, and that's going to be the opinion of 90% of the world.
And I want you to go first, and I'm going to say this as delicately as I can, it's that you're a little older than we are, and you've been in the business a lot longer than we have. So you're the type of guy that if I was going to be like, what's Keanu's movie? You've seen every phase of his career. What calls out to you the most?
I would have to say Point Break.
Really?
That's the career defining role. But really, Johnny Utah.
Yes,
that's
because it was established him in the action sort of space. It established his character and defined his limitations, I believe. When he came off of like a Bill and Ted's, which was probably his most popular one at the time, and he came into that, it basically said, here's the box you're going to play in, boy.
Yep.
And from this moment on, you're kind of got to stay in that. And so when you talk career defining, I say like that put the parameters to where his success would be in his career. And then The Matrix would be not a career defining, but a sort of a career pinnacle for him, which is like the best version of him in the biggest movie and the most success. But once he did Point Break, and he said, I am an FBI agent, you know what I mean? That moment was cement. Those were cement acting shoes right there.
So I love the points that you make on that, and it actually changed my mind. But my question with that is for the audience is like, when people say, or when you say Keanu Reeves, what is the role that you think pops in most people's mind?
Well, it would have to be The Matrix, only because it's the most popular and the most current for the largest demographic.
And so I think the second half of your answer was essentially like the answer to that question, which is the career pinnacle.
Yeah.
And I would agree that Neo is a career-defining role. I mean, some guys, even if they have a character they've played a lot of times, like Mel Gibson's played Riggs in Lethal Weapon 4 times, and he won an Oscar for Braveheart, but I don't think Mel Gibson has a career-defining role. Whereas I do think Keanu does. I think because... So Point Break's my single favorite movie of all time.
Yeah.
I love the movie more than anything. I've seen it probably 50 times. Speed, I adore Speed.
Love Speed.
I love the John Wick movies. Bill and Ted's are fantastic. And there's only one good Matrix movie.
Yeah.
But doesn't change the fact that if I think about Keanu Reeves and I think about generationally, like our generation, a younger generation, an older generation, it's all going to come back to The Matrix.
Yeah.
It all comes back to Neo because, let's be honest, Bill and Ted is past. The third one will get made at some point, but...
They're working on it right now.
Yeah, there's a couple people bidding over it, right?
Yeah.
That will get made at some point. They remade Point Break. No one saw it. He had nothing to do with it. He wasn't even in the movie. Speed had a bad sequel. There's never probably going to be a Speed 3.
Nope.
Basically, John Wick will have another movie, and it'll probably be more like a Taken 3, where very less people will see it, because it's kind of the nature of these things. And I think probably The Matrix won't fade. The Matrix...
No, it can't.
It's iconic in a way.
It's one of the most
important
movies ever made. That's so crazy, because... I was actually going to say Bill and Ted is his most career-defining role.
Really?
And I've never even seen Bill and Ted.
Really?
I've never seen Bill and Ted,
which is
funny because I had
He's never really done another comedy.
Right.
So it's like, it's hard to say that defined his career.
The reason that I say, so when we talk career-defining roles a lot on the show, we talk about like the role that when you say his name, that's what people think of. And for some reason, for me, Neo feels like it's most correct because, you know, I'm almost 30 now, so there's this generation younger and older than me that are still all in, still just as invested in movies as I am. So Neo felt the most correct.
Yeah.
But Bill and Ted is the one where it's like, that's what got him started. That's Keanu Reeves. Like, that is who he is to everyone. Like, even for someone that's never seen it, I'm like, oh yeah, Bill and Ted's actually no better. Bill and Ted's
But to be fair, who was the other guy in Bill and Ted's?
Alex Winter.
Yeah, that got him started too, and look how that went. So getting started is not your career. It's,
but if we're talking about
cast in movies,
roles that define who you are as a person, like as an actor, I do have to agree it's Neo. But you're so right when you make that point about Johnny Utah.
True.
His career, he would have never been Neo had he not been Johnny Utah.
And that's, I'm telling you, there's a story that gets told a lot, and I'd heard it before, but it's about Catherine Bigelow fighting for him to be in that movie, and they're like, you want to put
this
Ted in Point Break across from Swayze as an FBI agent?
Yeah.
And she's like, yes. And they're like, no. And she's like, trust me, this is the guy. And they're like, well, let's meet him. And they turned him down. It was like, we need to put him in this movie. Mm-hmm. He's the only guy that can play this role. And she convinced him. And that's Keanu's whole career.
Look at him now. Yes. You know?
Yeah.
So I actually, I do think it's Neo, but I think that the most important movie he ever did was Point Break.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. You know, I was just thinking about this. So you talk about when there's a trilogy and the first one is so impactful. Like, The Matrix was so impactful.
It's almost a perfect movie.
Yeah. It's unbelievable. We did it on the show, and it was like, when we watched it again.
It just shows that whoever wrote The Matrix probably didn't write the other two.
Yeah.
No matter what those guys say.
So the second and third movie are bad. Those are not good movies. I can remember virtually nothing that happens in those movies.
It's like, well, this is experience of riding the coattails of something. You want something so bad that you'll accept it.
So let's say Viggo for a second, all right? So Aragorn is Viggo's role. That's like no question. That's not even a, there's not even really a conversation about that being a career defining role. What if the first movie had come out, had been just as successful as it was, Fellowship of the Ring, but Two Towers and Return of the King had been god awful, like on the level of the two Matrix movies?
I can't even think about what that world would be like.
Let's just assume they were.
See, I almost live in that world because really? I didn't like. You don't either like those movies.
Oh my god!
I loved the first one.
Yeah,
I didn't really like the second or the third one. That
so
much.
Let's assume that worldwide they had made money, but no one cared, and like they had literally gone down as those other two movies. You have to wonder. Would Aragorn be Viggo's role? Because at this point, Eastern Promises, he won Oscar nomination for that role. I mean, like, he's been in a ton of big movies.
There's only one, though. Because that those movies, you cannot fight against Lord of the Rings. You can't compete.
And you also have to have another big movie to be defining for people.
Yeah, it's true.
He doesn't really have another breakout movie.
And those are three of the biggest, most successful, greatest movies of all time by most of the audience.
And don't forget, like, for Keanu, like, Speed was a monster film.
Monster.
So now you're talking about a guy who's got three monster films and a cult sort of Bill and Ted classic kind of thing. Like, that's nothing to shake a stick at. Like, he's got some real, like, you could have, now it doesn't take three guys to argue over whether The Matrix is his defining, like, is his biggest one that's most known, but what put him in those roles and continued to put him in those roles and stopped him from going in comedy and going in drama and going in any other thing to find out he's maybe a mediocre actor was the fact that Point Break was a amazing movie and he was sort of typecast from there and he was able to stay in that lane and be incredibly successful.
That's such a cool fucking point, man. I'm so glad that you brought that up.
Yeah. So let's move through production development. We've talked about this on the last episode. You want to walk us through really quickly on this one? There's a couple interesting points.
Yeah, I mean, there's not a whole lot to talk about with production of this film. It almost feels like just regurgitating talking about the first John Wick.
Yeah.
So basically, after John Wick got released, it was almost instant. They were like, this is going to be a trilogy because it was so successful. They made so much money, and they were all surprised by it. So, what's his name? Basil Ivanyek. Ivanyek is the head of Thunder Road Productions. They're the guys that took on John Wick, and Lionsgate and Summit are the one that picked it up for distribution. They really just kind of took a shot in the dark on this. I don't know why exactly they thought at the time it was what they needed to do. I don't know if they... I mean, the first movie cost less than $40 million, $30 million, right?
Yeah,
this one's 40. I think the first one was like 20. So
less
it's still an it's still a lot of money. You know that. Yeah. You know, you've been a producer. You know,
40 mil still.
It's still an inordinate... Yeah. I mean, a lot of money. But for a massive action blockbuster, especially a sequel, like $40 million isn't a lot.
Yep.
You know, so... Anyway, so they took a...
The company I'm with, STX Entertainment, their entire world is built in budgets at that range for high-profile stars that want to do passion projects, and it's all in that $30 to $50 million range, and it's a lot of money, but in that world, that those are low-budget films.
Actions, it's hard to do action for 40 unless you're hard. Ryan Johnson doing Looper.
Yeah, well, exactly. When we covered Looper, that's still one of the... $40 million to make that movie is just absolutely incredible. So in February 2015, the directors Chad Stahelski and David Leitch decided they were going to develop the second film. Now, Stahelski and Leitch, they actually co-directed the first movie, but due to the DGA... basically saying you can only have one director to a movie unless there's an extreme extenuating circumstance, like the Coen brothers, for instance, or people that are related. You have to have one director, and the other person has to be a producer. So Leitch happily fell into that producer role, and I'm pretty sure there hasn't been a lot out about this movie because it's new, but I'm pretty positive they took on the same co-directing style as they did in the first one, and they kept their respective roles in the credits.
And the most interesting thing that, I mean, you haven't pointed out here, but it's pretty common knowledge, is that these guys had worked in the stunt world for 20 plus years
Keanu
had doubled Keanu forever going back to, you know, the Matrix movies and prior, so they knew him, and
that's a tough leap to come out a stuntman and be like, hey, I want to direct a movie and that kind of stuff. That's not easy to do,
but that's how you get Keanu involved. That's how you get the name.
Point Break, they did all the Matrix
movies. But again,
movies
at the time,
him.
That wasn't like, hey, guess what, we got Keanu, yeehaw.
Yeah,
it was like,
can we please have 40 million? Please give us 40.
That was tough at the time. Jockman won. That was a very still a tough sell,
but definitely. These guys, knowing, working with him, that they wanted him on board, they needed Keanu to be their dude because he was kind of their segue into moving from stunt coordinating to directing. So they also, the other credits they worked on were like 300, The Wolverine, Mr. and Mrs. Smith. they also worked on The Bourne Ultimatum, So, is there anything else you want to talk about with these guys specifically?
No, I mean, that's, you pretty much nailed it with those guys. That's the most important stuff with those guys. Derek Kolstad,
the writer,
yeah, also wrote the first film, and he, I mean, if you look at the stuff that he got to start, like a rewrite on the Cuba Gooding Dolph movie, One in the Chamber. I mean, like, Cuba Gooding and Dolph in a movie is already, like, that's just already entertaining enough.
Hilarious cast.
It's funny because I've always said, like, that's the dream job for me in Hollywood is production rewrites.
Yeah.
Right.
Because they get paid a lot of money.
They do.
The script's already done, and you just gotta, like, change a few things and make it better. It's like, it's hard, and you don't take credit. If you do the production rewrites on Geely or Ishtar, some bomb,
it's like, hey,
you don't tell anybody. Nobody knows. Yeah. If you did production rewrites on Braveheart, you get to be like, yeah, that was me.
I wrote that movie.
Yeah, it's a fantastic
I wrote the
gig.
Thing.
Yeah. So
yeah, it's funny. It's a hard gig to get though. There's a lot of people that want to do that.
Listen,
yeah.
I still haven't done it.
So yeah, basically, Kolstad had the idea in the first place that he wanted to make this movie, and essentially the premise for him was like, you have this guy, he was Satan, he leaves the life, he goes to hell, somebody pulls him out of, you know, somebody tries to pull him out, do the gates of hell open up, and he brings hell back with him, and that's the whole premise, and it was a fan-fucking-tastic premise for the first movie. Didn't really have to do a whole lot to make the second movie aside from build this assassin world, which is the coolest part of the movie, and I give him lots of credit for creating that world, because that's unbelievable.
And as crazy as it is like, John Wick, for people out there that just think it's a throwaway action movie, it was a winner, and it was featured on the Blacklist, you know, for the best...
The script,
The script was on there for the best unproduced scripts in Hollywood, or in 2012.
As we've seen with Passengers, that doesn't always work out so well. Yeah. Though I actually heard somebody telling me the other day that that movie is, like, you should... they were like, it got bombed, you should watch it. I skipped it because I heard it was so bad.
Yeah, same.
And on top of that, I don't remember who directed that movie, but it's directed by somebody totally relevant that you would be surprised directed it.
I can't remember.
Like, more of an artistic director. This came up in trivia the other day, and I was like, what?
Skipped it.
All right, so moving on here. There's not a lot about productions other than...
Yeah, it just came out. I mean, all the stuff that'll come out. Yeah, down the road.
So, this was released by Lionsgate and Summit. It cost $40 million to make. It opened last weekend. Made $30 million domestically, an additional $11 million worldwide for a gross total of $41 million, making back its budget. But it did get destroyed at the box office by Lego Batman at $53 million and 50 Shades Darker at $46 million.
The one thing I would say about this...
It's not going to beat Lego.
No. They've got to be happy they made back their money in the first weekend.
Of course.
That's great.
Yeah.
But I will say, the promotion budget on this movie, the marketing, was so much bigger than the first movie.
Yeah, so you're talking about another 10 to 15 in that, for sure.
It'll make it back. And then the VOD on this one. So this movie's going to be very successful in the third
it'll
one.
It'll be very profitable.
Absolutely, yeah. It's just, you know, it's not going to
because the first one didn't
Lego
have
Batman.
The same international reach as this one already had. It didn't, and so they'll hit 50 or 60 domestically anyways, and then this will cross $100 million for them.
Oh,
so
yeah.
That'll be good.
And even the domestic reach. Did you see John Wick in theaters, the first one?
No.
I didn't know.
No.
Yeah, exactly. None of us did.
I mean, Keanu's also one of those stars. It's weird. We talk about this sometimes on the show. Denzel being the great example of the hugely successful guy that does not do that well internationally. Keanu actually does pretty well internationally. Even on smaller pictures, he still makes money.
Yeah.
That's a bizarre conversation. In fact,
I think it's because of movies like The Matrix and Scanner Darkly that, like...
Yeah.
Is that race? Oh, no, it absolutely is. We've talked about that 100 times. There's a reason why Denzel's box office is lower than Tom Cruise's.
Yeah,
because the rest of the world's racist.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's
a lot of it is. So before we move into the critical, I want to pull up really quickly. I pulled the box office where John Wick 1 ended up landing domestically.
For the year?
Yeah, because it's really interesting if you look at the movies that it finished around. Because we all know John Wick 2 is going to end somewhere like in the top 25 this year probably. John Wick 1, I think, if you blow this up for us, I think it's like number 71 domestically or something like that. And
this
I found this to be
ahead of?
I found this to be fascinating. So you have
A Million Ways Down the West.
Yeah. John Wick is number 77 that year, right?
Uh-huh.
So if you go up, you've got The Judge, right, coming in at number 70. So The Judge
makes
a Duvall
movie and Downey?
Yeah, that made more money. Birdman finishes one behind John Wick. Birdman won Best Picture.
Yeah, but its theatrical run was done by then, right?
That is hilarious.
I just like, sometimes I find these to be fascinating because, like,
Need for Speed.
As you said, no one saw John Wick. So a movie that with the kind of cult appeal that can spawn a sequel that's going to make this much money.
Doesn't happen very often.
No.
This is lightning.
Yeah, 77. I mean, that's
like I said, it's
wild.
The Patriots and the
Super
Bowl.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Every single possible thing had to go exactly right.
Yeah. And if we're going to talk critically about this movie, like, IMDb gives it an 8.5. Rotten Tomatoes, all critics give it a 90. Top give it a 79. The audience gives it a 93.
Consistent with our normal, which is that the audience always has our movies on this show rated the highest.
Yep, always. Yeah. They did it right. This movie was so hard. John Wick was so hard to bring to the next level. How do you heighten this guy? And Now, I know you didn't feel like it was a little too long. Ben and I did. But it wasn't, like, too long. If you're watching this movie at home and you get up and go to the bathroom and you get up and get a drink, this movie feels the perfect
one. Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
What I mean, you're not just stuck in the theater seat.
Well, I think I found that, you know, the first opening scene was a little bit much. Like, I was like, whoa, we're right into this now. It was a lot of karate. I was hoping for more gunplay in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And then it sort of, like, got into the credits and stuff. So I was like, almost like that was okay, that was passed. Then I was interested in the plot coming up to the assassination. I was like, okay, this is going to be good.
Yep.
And then it went through this crazy blow-up. Oh, my God. And then it was like now he's got a new bad guy to go after.
Right.
Yeah.
So I found, like, plot progression time-wise was okay. So I didn't fault it for being too long. I thought it was okay.
Yeah. We talked about this a little bit after the movie, but Ruby Rose as a character was basically totally irrelevant.
Yeah.
She, like, didn't add anything to the movie.
And she didn't get a lot of money because she didn't have to say the word.
She was added to the movie because she's, like, a hot, sexy name right now, and people like her, and she's cool.
Unlucky.
And, but she's just...
Lucky, is that what you said?
I said unlucky.
Unlucky, yeah.
But unfortunately, this movie felt 25 minutes too long to me.
And it was her part.
You could get rid of her, and this movie would have been better.
Oh, you could have edited her out and
completely
never seen her.
The movie would
all.
Have just been better,
right.
Through and through. Like, you could have skipped a lot of the action that she's even in, and it's nothing against her. I mean, she didn't say anything.
Fine,
and she's fine.
There was never a moment though with her, even at the end, because she would. I mean, the second henchman, the last guy before the final boss, is always the toughest. That's how it's usually supposed to be, unless it's like a martial arts movie. You know, then the final guy's the toughest.
But it's Busey is more terrifying and Lethal Weapon than the old.
I got you.
Officer Murtaugh.
Don't be foolish.
Yeah. But she wasn't. Like, when you knew they were gonna fight, and they kept like building it up.
Yeah.
You knew that she wasn't even going to stand a chance.
Yeah, well, he had just killed 136 people.
Yeah, he had killed Common, who was like...
So you weren't a huge fan of Common.
He was all right.
I loved him in this movie.
I thought he was a good choice. He didn't have a lot of leeway to make this role sing.
Yeah. Right.
He needed to just stay in the lines, and I think he did that well, and it was fine. It was just like, oh, man, he had to fight that guy a lot.
Exactly.
You know? And the one scene, though, this was probably one of my favorite moments of the movie. When they roll down the stairs and they break into the...
roll down a lot of stairs.
Yeah. Eddie's like, maybe a drink to calm things down. Mm-hmm. And you're like, of course they're going to have a drink. And they're going to cheers.
It was cool.
Like, that was awesome.
That was so really cool.
Moment.
But for me, the lead up to that awesome moment was too long. Too many stairs. They fell...
Yeah.
The movie is the perfect metaphor. They fell down too many stairs.
Yeah.
One flight of stairs would have been fine.
Well, yeah, because I mean, that was another one of those moments where I was like... Listen, I've rolled down like six steps before.
Like six stairs, and I had to quit my job.
And it hurt like
died
crazy.
From that.
Yeah. I like broke a finger, I think.
And he was already shot at this time.
Yeah.
And got run over. And like
when a guy runs into your legs with a car from the side,
you're destroyed.
Ruptured all your tendons. You're Willis McGahee. Like you are screwed. Like there's no
And so it's like, I just don't know why they didn't make the decision to have him jump a little bit so it didn't look so like
anything.
Injuring.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that
he was too superhero-ish.
That was definitely the thing, and so the combination of those two things, but
and what's the problem, unfortunately, that's editorial choices.
Yes.
And that's really hard to do when you're so connected. I mean, I do this all the time. I put out shit on TV lots of times.
Yeah.
In my career, I have a lot of series I've done, and some of them not so great, because you get so connected to the process.
Yeah.
And you're so intimately connected to the work that you don't objectively look at it and make decisions, and editing that stuff is really, really hard.
So they could have cut out so many
half second,
and just the interaction between them. They didn't have to throw quite as many punches. They didn't have to you know, block each other so many times. And it would have been the same scene, one flight of stairs, and they end up in that cool moment, and that would have been progressing the story.
And you do that throughout the whole entire film, and you lose that 18 minutes.
Yeah.
So let me ask you really quickly before we get into our next segment, because you just made reference to something that we haven't even talked about, which is that you have put a lot of shows on television.
This is
a cool thing you've done.
Lots.
And in the world of what you do, getting as many shows on television as you have is a very successful and very incredibly difficult thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So
unbelievably
difficult. Is the show you've put on television you would say you're the most proud of, /successful, and also the one that you just like shake your head where you're just like, oh man,
why did I fight so hard for that?
That was
one.
My Under Siege 2 Dark Territory.
Yeah,
what is
it? Listen,
greatest sequel of all time.
You know, listen, that's tough because I sold a show called Extreme Makeover Weight Loss to ABC, which was an extreme makeover one for weight loss. It was a very difficult show to sell. When I went in to sell it to the network, I basically had to say, hey, listen, if you buy the show today, you won't have this on the air for like 16 months.
Yeah.
There's a good chance you might not even have your job by the time this gets on the air. But you got to buy it, and it's to be able to sell that was a really big moment. It was for me, that's a defining moment.
That's
in my career.
That's a pretty good selling point too.
And And then I can go through the list of like, oh, how that changed lives and affected people, which is great. But the truth is that, you know, I'm one of a giant team of people
sure.
that make these shows. My specialty is not physically making the show. Mm-hmm. So,
right.
So the sale of it and sort of the delivery of that is something that I'm super proud of. And Bar Rescue would probably be the other one because it's sort of culturally the biggest hit that I sort of orchestrated and put together and built. But again, like, I am not responsible for the overall success of Bar Rescue because the people who work on it every day and designed it mm-hmm. and were in the field and giving notes every day, those are the guys who sort of like made it. And John Taffer. So, you know, I'm more of a producer in the sense that I package these things and sell them. So that was a big thing for me. You know, so a mixed bag is I...
you're skirting the second question, which I'm really
I had a show that I put on very early in my career on network television on Fox called The Princes of Malibu.
Okay.
I know this show.
Princes of Malibu. Exactly. Which was the birth and the foremost notice of everybody on TV of Spencer Pratt and the Kardashians and Brody Jenner. Oh, their entire sort of career and TV career sort of spawned from that moment. And so that's one of those ones where it's like, oh yeah, that was me. So
all right,
well yeah, but you gave the world these people that are the
princes
massive,
of Malibu.
Yeah, so that was a pretty funny sort of
all right
run. So
fair enough. Well,
I mean, hats off to you either way, because Ben and I, and for our audience that doesn't know, we pitch shows and we work very hard.
Digital concepts, and you put a lot of work, and then it doesn't go.
No fucking joke.
Oh yeah, and I mean, I do a lot of sort of consulting and speaking, and I say like. More than 9 out of 10 of the things that I pitch don't get bought. Yeah. So I go out every day and pitch shows that don't go anywhere all day, every day.
Yeah.
So that's tough to deal with. And then the networks buy, you know, they'll hear 1,000 pitches a year and buy 10 things. And then 9 crazy. Of those will fail.
Right.
So it's like, welcome to the world of this. And that's because, to your original thesis, none of us know
anything
about what we're doing.
Full circle. Yeah.
All right, so bringing it back to Keanu, his greatest successes, we're going to count down right now in a top 5, our top 5 Keanu Reeves movies. Who doesn't love a top 5? So I think it's pretty safe to say, based on a lot of the conversations we've already had today and the acknowledgments of one another's favorite movies, probably 3 of our top 5s will be the same, I'm guessing. But let's count backwards, starting with 5, and we'll each do our 5, because I'm assuming 5 and 4, possibly 3, will be the interesting ones. But maybe I'm off here. So I'm going to start out with my number 5, and that's going to be The River's Edge. 1986.
What is that movie?
Directed by Tim Hunter, starring Crispin Glover, Keanu Reeves, Dennis Hopper, and Ione Skye.
Why?
Is that even a real movie?
Are you saying this to like show off that you know about movies?
No, I told you, there's 9 or 10 that
I've got access to IMDb, and here he is.
Right. There was like 9 or 10 interesting ones that were like, they could have been my 5th.
When you watch it, you let us know how it is.
Yeah. It's like a murder mystery coming of age movie with a bunch of weird characters, but it's awesome. It's like,
good.
If people haven't seen it, like if you're thinking like darker, weirder Keanu movies from that time, like maybe like My Own Private Idaho or movies like that.
I haven't seen that in so long.
Yeah, it's a good movie. River's Edge is worth it. Parenthood was probably my number 6. That was my honorable mention because I loved that movie. I loved the movie growing up. Those are like my weird ones, but...
You're not going to talk about The Replacements?
No, I didn't love The Replacements.
No, my number 5 is the Devil's Advocate.
Okay, yes. Tony Gilroy.
My number 5 is also The Devil's Advocate.
Is it really? Yes. Wow! Yes. That's amazing. That's I can't believe this number 5 is the same.
Boom, there's a fist bump moment for you.
Yeah, so wow.
I love that movie.
I can't believe you guys both have the same number 5. That blows my mind.
Weird, creepy movie, man.
Yeah.
And what's your number 4?
Yeah.
Well, so just quickly on The Devil's Advocate, because we've done every Bourne movie on the show.
Yeah.
The Devil's Advocate is written by Tony Gilroy.
I did not know that.
The writer of all those movies, the writer and director of Michael Clayton. It's like one of my favorite movies of all time.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah, that's interesting. My number 4, I'm going to go with John Wick 1. So I struck John Wick 2 from the record because it's too brand new.
I
loved it, but I can't do it.
It's low.
So John Wick 1 is my number 4.
It's like a Russian judge and ice skating there. What is going on?
Yeah. My number 4 is Point Break.
I've got to list it all.
Yeah.
You know where it's going to be for me. So
yeah, it's terrible. My number 4 is Speed.
Nice.
Yeah, Speed. So I think we're going to start to have some duplicates here. Speed's great. Speed was the third or fourth episode we ever did on this show?
I think so.
Yeah, we've done... we've done Wick, we've done Speed, we've done Point Break.
Mm-hmm.
We have not done the
Chain Reaction.
We have not done the River's Edge. We never will.
Nope.
My number 3 is going to be Speed. That's my...
Okay.
Yeah.
Mine is John Wick at 3.
Mine was The Matrix.
Yeah.
Wow.
That low.
Yeah.
I can't wait to hear your number one and two. All right, so what's your two, baby?
So my two is The Matrix.
Okay, mine's Speed.
Yeah.
My number two is John Wick, the original.
Okay, fair.
Yeah, and then number one for me is Point Break, the best.
And mine is Matrix.
Yeah. And mine is Point Break.
Yeah.
Okay. Nice! Two out of three with the Point Break number one.
Fair enough.
So you love Point Break. You adore that
movie. I love Point Break, like, crazy love it.
Where would you rank Point Break on your all-time action movies?
It is in my top 10. In my action movies, it's in the top, for sure, top 5.
Nice.
It could be top 3.
And on your favorite movies of all time?
Top 10 for sure.
Without, wow.
Really? Without question.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, you guys liked each other. Yeah.
When I was in elementary school, I was in sixth grade, actually. I was 11 years old. My brother gave me a VHS copy of Point Break. And he was like, we watch this all the time. And he gave me that in The Player, the Tim Robbins movie, and which is great. But
I mean, I know that movie inside and out, like the back of my hand. It's part of my sort of vernacular in life.
So good.
And funny story is I wrote a script one time back in the day when I was just doing lots of stuff and I was all popular and I was like the cool kid in town kind of thing for a hot moment. So I was writing a couple screenplays. And I wrote a screenplay that was scene for scene with Point Break. And when I was writing the screenplay, I literally watched Point Break and just restructured the scene.
Was it called The Fast and the Furious?
No.
Fast
and Furious is identical, of course. And that is why I did it. This was about a TV crew that was in nightclubs that robbed the nightclubs. What?
Oh.
Get crazy.
That makes sense.
Anyways, so I literally copied it scene for scene.
Tyler, I lied to you because I thought you would leave. Good guess, huh? Fuck, why am I so bad at this?
That voicemail's one of the worst things ever. Why am I so bad at this?
That's my favorite thing ever. All right, guys, that's our top 5 Keanu Reeves movies. If you like a 5 that are different than our 5, or you have one you wanted to throw in there, you guys have any honorable mentions that almost made it for you? I told you Parenthood was close for me. I actually love Something's Gotta Give that almost made it for me. I do really like that movie. Devil's Advocate is really good. I mean, wouldn't have thought it was
five. I would have struggled to get another one on there.
Yeah, okay. I honestly did. Yeah. I was like, maybe I would just throw Bill and Ted on.
None of us had Bill and Ted, right?
Yeah.
No, well, I didn't even like Bill and Ted when it came out. I wasn't a big fan of it. Like, I didn't, you know, same with Wayne's World. I wasn't a huge fan of that. Like, slaps the goofy over the top kind of. I just wasn't a big into that.
Sure.
So it never, like, stuck for me.
I like Bill and Ted's. I don't think I ever saw the second one more than one time, but I watched it growing up a lot, the first one. It's not my favorite movie.
Yeah.
So anyway, moving on to our favorite line. This will be one of the final games we play here, guys.
I was waiting for this.
Me too.
Yeah.
I have a great favorite line.
Go ahead. Jump in, please.
My favorite line in the whole movie is when he arrives at the Continental in Rome.
Yeah.
And he talks to the guy that's in charge. Is this yours too?
Yeah, for sure.
No!
For sure.
I'm sorry, man. But it's when he says he wants to check in, and he turns around. There's the guy, and he talks to him. He's like, John Wick, you're here. And he's like,
May I ask you one question?
Yeah, they start speaking, and he's like, are you here to kill the Pope?
That was my favorite line by a mile.
So good, because...
I must ask you one question.
Yeah. Are you here for the Pope?
Are you here for the Pope?
Yeah.
And then just the look on John Wick, he's like, no.
And the best thing is
that... my favorite line, too.
John Wick is the only person that can kill the Pope,
and
that guy knows it.
But it was sort of defining... like element of the sort of throwback to the whole series of the idea, like this guy and this syndicate network and these, like what he represents, that's where they think, like he could be there to kill the Pope. It's the most outrageous thing ever.
Exactly.
It's
John Wick's coming out of retirement, he's gonna either kill the Pope, the Queen, or the President.
Yeah,
because that played into the idea, like in the first film, where it was really cool how everybody knew him. You know, like when he was with Kevin Nash or whatever in the Bodyguard, it's like, oh hey, Mr. Wick, like everybody knew him because he's famous.
Yeah.
And that was like sort of a homage to that moment where it's like, oh yeah, he's that popular. The question is like, oh shit, he's in Rome. Are you here for the Pope?
Yeah, it's so cool.
Like, that was great. My favorite line.
That was great.
My favorite was when we have Peter Stormare. What's his
name? Yeah, Peter Stormare.
Stormare, in the initial Russian dude, and he's telling the story of the guy. And he's like, he's trying to tell the story. He's like, this fucking guy's like with a pencil. I know. I've heard the story. But then as soon as he said that, I was like, we're going to see the pencil this movie.
Yeah,
I was like, we're definitely going to see the fucking pencil.
Yeah. Fucking pencil.
So as soon as he said that, I was like, that's awesome. Because I laughed out loud. And I was like, when's the pencil coming? Because I know we're going to get it.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that was great. So that was my favorite.
So good.
Yeah, it's fucking. If they hadn't shown I'm gonna kill him, I'm gonna kill them all in the trailer, maybe I would have liked that moment more. But I just
it was a little bit.
I was like, yeah, we just saw you kill everyone. So
one thing I will say is there were actually two more lines that I thought were really cool. It was one that Lawrence Fishburne says to John Wick about the scar on his neck. He's like, you gave me a choice that day. Either I could pull my gun and shoot you and die, or I could hold my neck and live. Because he like slit his throat. I thought that was cool. But what I thought was cooler was when they came back to Common later, I guess. Fishburne thing happened afterwards. But it was like kind of a tribute to the Common thing. Like, him, if he respects you, apparently, he might not kill you. He'll give you an option to either live or die.
Right. So is Comet alive? Is that what we're to assume? Because he stabbed him through the...
I think so.
If you pull it out, you're going to bleed out?
Yeah, so if he goes into a hospital and you pull it out, then you can immediately take care of it. Yeah. I don't know if that's true or not, but I just thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, agreed. It's all these characters, right?
It was a good line.
Yeah, it was cool.
It's the save the cat moment. You need him to do something to inform redeeming. Their character in that way.
Yeah.
So anyway, guys, I don't think we really have time to get into Cage versus Cruz. No. Unfortunately, I'm sorry.
By the
guys.
Way, Tom Cruise could have done this movie. Nicolas Cage, no.
Yeah. Yeah. No. Yeah, I mean, it's usually just us doing stupid impressions. That's what the segment's really about. But yeah. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, we do some good impressions on here. But
I can imagine.
So there are three action movie categories. This one's really interesting. So there's three categories. Totally ridiculous, totally legitimate, and ridiculously legitimate. Totally ridiculous movies are like Con Air and Face Off. They are laugh your way to the bank, hilarious.
Demo Man,
just,
you know.
Yeah, they're awesome, but they're like really too silly. Totally legitimate movies are going to be movies like Lone Survivor, The Fugitive, even like a Terminator 2, which is pretty grounded in drama. Doesn't really make you laugh unintentionally. And
yeah,
the middle category...
it has like aliens and robots, it's still... it holds together well.
The middle category, it's defined by movies like Predator, Point Break, Speed...
The Rock.
The Rock. Yeah, they're awesome, usually very compelling, have at least one element that's really strong, but there's definitely some unintentional laughs. It's hard to avoid with a movie like Predator, even if it's awesome. Yeah. Point Break, I laugh throughout, even though it's great. This movie is a hard one to define for me. I can't decide if I think it's definitely not totally legitimate for me.
No,
definitely not.
For me,
it's like, it's kind of totally ridiculous.
Yeah.
If you're not a big fan of John Wick 1 and like this genre, it's totally ridiculous because the superhero element of it is so over the top. And the lack of anything else but that sort of similar fighting technique and style over and over and over again. Damn my it. Wife left the theater.
Wow, really?
Yeah. She wasn't feeling great, and she was just like, yeah, I've seen enough.
Yeah.
Is it okay? And we had separate cars. So it was like, she's like, is it okay if I just go home? And I was like, yeah, get out.
You know, you've swayed me twice tonight now with my opinion, and I actually have to agree.
Totally
I was
going
to say that it was ridiculously legitimate because of the world that they create.
Yeah.
That's my favorite part, and that's what makes it feel real to me. But you're right, man. Like, you cut out all that extra shit, the extra couple rolls, the extra flight of stairs, the extra gunshots, and you've got a great fucking movie.
Yeah.
Whereas in this one, you are constantly suspending belief. John Wick would have died 15 times by the time this movie was over. 100 times.
I'm going to say this is ridiculously legitimate for me.
Really?
And the reason I say it is because the precision of the action, the execution of what they do, and the execution of creating the Assassin's world, those two things are memorable enough and of high enough quality. When I think about the movies, for me, like, Face Off's awesome, but, like, Face Off doesn't do anything that's definitive or groundbreaking. I mean, Con Air doesn't do anything definitive or groundbreaking. They're like rehashes of other styles. This is a pretty unique experience. There's only a few movies I can think of ever that have this level.
Yeah.
So that's, to me, what grounds it and keeps it valuable and why.
But I think there's enough of a detraction.
I hear you.
Yeah,
it's close. The number and the sheer volume of that action.
I was going
to make it feel like, you know what, it just, it, the precision of it would have been better served with less. With less of it, less, more on the quality and less on the quantity.
Yeah.
And then you could have qualified in your sort of totally ridiculously legitimate.
Yep.
Yeah.
But
I
I'm
agree.
Okay. You should have an asterisk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which
it's
is
close.
Like, I'm totally okay with
it. It's right on the edge. Yeah.
I was going to make the same argument that the world itself grounds it into reality and makes it ridiculously legitimate, but I can't do it.
Yeah. All right. So, guys, we only have one category left on the show, and that is called The Pitch. So this week, guys, we're going to do what we did a couple weeks ago, where two weeks ago, picked three of your guilty movie pleasures on a poll on Twitter, and that was how we ended up doing The Punisher from 2004 with Thomas Jane.
Sweet movie.
Movies that didn't make it that week were The Art of War.
And The Ghost in the Darkness.
I loved that movie.
Right? Yes!
I loved it!
Do you love The Edge also with Alec Baldwin and
you know
Anthony
what?
Hopkins where they fight the bear?
I do. Yes, I did love that movie.
That's one of our favorite episodes we ever did.
Yeah, really?
I
love that
so
movie.
Good,
we adore that movie.
It's hard to know what you're supposed to love. You don't want to get any...
No.
I love whatever you want.
So, guys, go follow us on at MA Podcast. You're going to find my three guilty movie pleasures. I have to really think hard about this, what I want to put up there. This is my one shot to put up three ridiculous movies.
Don't blow it.
I can't use a shoe, and I got to go with one that we never would be able to do on the show otherwise. And you go follow us at MA Podcast. You'll be able to vote on that. You can find me personally at Ben Bateman Media. Brant, where can the folks find you?
At Brant Pinvinic. Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
Yep, and you guys can find me at Andrew Guy.
and check out Brandt's movies. He's got he's got two out there. They're free. You can watch them free on YouTube.
Well, you can watch the short on film. I can't get my Facebook one to be free yet. Amazon's still selling it. So unless you're a Prime member, it's on Amazon Prime.
Everybody should be on Prime. Yeah, and
By the way, you just type in Facebook on Amazon Prime. It's the first thing that comes.
Really?
Up. Boom!
I wish that was the case with any of the movies we do on the show. That would be great.
That'd be amazing.
Search John Wick 2, our episode. Great. Anyway, guys, thank you for watching. We will see you same time, same place next week. Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Brant.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the entire Popcorn Talk Network, we would like to thank you for tuning in. For questions or comments, be sure to visit popcorntalk.com. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been a presentation of the Popcorn Talk Network.
The views expressed herein are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Popcorn Talk Network or its owners or principals.